Welcome to Who Cares Wins with me, Lily Cole. At the heart of every issue that intersects with the environment, you find contradictions, tensions, and divergent perspectives. And these issues are complex and changing. Most of us want a happy life and a healthy planet, but many people have different ideas about the right way to travel towards it. In this podcast series, I'll be interviewing some of the leading and conflicting voices in contemporary debates, such as technology, food, gender, politics, and looking at how they intersect with our environment. I see myself a bit like sellotape, ribbon, or string, holding together divergent voices and sort of asking, who cares who wins? New Year, ancient wisdom. In welcoming in the new year, 2022, we wanted to reflect on some of the oldest voices in the world, oldest in terms of community knowledge, indigenous voices that gathered at the International Climate Summit, COP26, in Glasgow late last year. I had gone to Glasgow for COP, specifically to help organise indigenous listening sessions, in collaboration with organisations such as Flourishing Diversity, Isla and Grounded, and several committed activists. As the name implies, the concept of an Indigenous listening session is just that, to listen to some of the oldest communities in the world at this critical moment in time. After writing Who Cares Wins and looking at hundreds, if not thousands, of different climate solutions, Indigenous wisdom is where I place most of my hope that humanity can make the shifts that are needed to create a sustainable lifestyle on this planet. Because Indigenous communities show that it's possible, it's been done. Many of these communities are thousands of years old, demonstrating human lifestyles compatible with the natural environment around them. Although Indigenous peoples represent less than 5% of the global population today, their land holds around 80% of current global biodiversity. There are 300 million Indigenous peoples worldwide, from tropical rainforests to the Arctic Circle, with around 5,000 distinct cultures representing 95% of the world's cultural diversity and treasure troves of ancient ancestral knowledge. So I'll try my best not to generalize about what Indigenous wisdom might mean, because diversity is part of it. But here present a few glimpses into some of the worldviews shared by the Indigenous communities that came to COP. For our listening sessions, we had 11 speakers from 5 continents. And in this episode, I want to guide you through some of the main themes that many of them spoke to. Let's start with how we describe the Earth. Whilst the language inside COP was quite clinical, pragmatic, businesslike, I participated, for example, in a panel on nature and land use, the idea of use being implicit in those formats. By contrast, the language that the Indigenous communities were using and often use to describe nature is much more sacred, reciprocal, even familial. The concept of Earth as Mother Earth or Sky as Father Sky, of a kinship with the animals and the land around us, comes up again and again from different cultures and different continents around the world. So here I'll share some of the type of language that was familiar to these sessions.
So I'm going to start this episode by sharing some of the audio clips from the listening sessions we held in COP26 that echo this type of language. Please note that most of this audio was recorded live at the Conference of the Parties, better known as COP, listening sessions in late 2021. Some of the speakers required translation, so sometimes you will hear them speaking in the background with a translator speaking on top. We'll open with a song from Chief Ninawa from the Hunaquin tribe in Acre, Brazil, where I've had the pleasure to be. Following him, you'll hear from a member of the Otomi Toltec Nation of Mexico, Mindahi Bastida. Then you'll hear from Christian Julio from the Pancararu indigenous land in northeast Brazil, and Sonia Guarajara, an indigenous activist and politician, also from the Amazon in Brazil. Both Christiane and Sonia are co-founders of the National Articulation of Indigenous Women Warriors of Ancestrality, I love that name. After Sonia, you'll hear from Victoria Tally Corpus. Victoria is a leader from the Kankanaye Igorot people of the Cordillera region in the Philippines. And she was appointed as the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Rights of Indigenous People by the Human Rights Council from 2014 to 2020. Then you'll hear from Tom BK Goldtooth from the Navajo, Diné and Dakota peoples, Executive Director of the Indigenous Environmental Network. And following him, you'll hear from Ariel Chwichwizaranja from the Athabasca Chipewyan First Nation in what's now known as Canada, who's a co-founder of the organization Indigenous Climate Action. I hope you can sit back and be transported, listening to these voices carrying ancient wisdom gathered from around the world.
Many of our actions have been putting Mother Earth through various types of sicknesses. But we also have the opportunity to take responsibility to envision how do we wish to solve these problems, how do we wish to tackle them.
If we want to really respect life, we have to acknowledge the spirit of other beings. The spirit of the mountain, the spirit of the river, the spirit of the sea, the spirit of Father Sky, and the spirit of the Mother Earth. Mother Earth is speaking. Mother Earth is crying, but still with lots of love towards us. We got to listen. It's a responsibility.
Nature will continue living without us. Can we live without nature right now? The calling of Mother Earth is now.
We are here to echo the call of Mother Earth because she is crying, and it is our duty to replicate her call while we still have time. What happens when she stops crying?
When we talk about lands and territories, we just don't talk about the physical land. We talk about the knowledge, the cultures, and the identities that are very much linked with these territories.
As indigenous peoples, to share our knowledge. That knowledge goes back thousands of years in passing on certain original instructions on how to exist and how to walk on the sacredness of our Mother Earth, and to understand the creative balance and the natural laws of creation and the relationship of Unchimaka, Grandmother Earth, and Father Sky, Grandpa Sky. Additional knowledge does not compromise. It does not make deals, because we're dealing with the natural laws of the mother of the forests of the South. The spiritual woman of the forest, she doesn't negotiate. The Mother Earth is very firm. So that guides us.
To know what it means to be in relationship with the natural world, to know what it means to understand the stories of the water, the stories of the land, the stories of the sky, the stories of who we are as Indigenous peoples, and how those stories provide us answers in relationship and reciprocity with the land and with each other. We are coming with one unified voice as Indigenous peoples. We are bringing one unified message, not many. It is one message. We need to reconnect with our place in the natural world and understand our roles and responsibilities on this planet.
If so many different cultures around the world have a similar type of language that sees nature as sacred, why is our language so different? When did it change? Why does modern culture and our modern media often not embrace the sacred, the mysterious, the familial in the way we speak of one another, other species, and nature itself? Indeed, why do we often not recognize ourselves as nature? Was it always this way? To understand these shifts, we have to look with a historical lens. The scientific, highly pragmatic, and many would say exploitative worldview that defines modern, quote, civilization, has dominated and shaped the world in recent centuries. Only 100 years ago, Western society assumed itself superior to indigenous peoples. The colonizers were, quote, discoverers of a new world. They othered indigenous peoples, exhibiting them in human zoos and international exhibitions as examples of primitivism. In 1904, Otto Benga, a Mbuti pygmy man, was displayed in a cage with a monkey in the Bronx Zoo, and the New York Times wrote, quote, the pygmies are very low in the human scale. Yet less than a few centuries since colonial expansion, Western society is discovering its own hubris, as our scientists tell us that we are on the path to making our only home uninhabitable, fueling a rate of mass extinction not seen in millions of years. Language connecting colonial history with climate change cropped up again and again in Glasgow around COP26. For example, at the Climate Justice March, several Indigenous delegations carried signs that read, "Colonization created climate change. Indigenous peoples are the solution." This is what Ariel had to say in the first Indigenous listening session.
This is the message that Indigenous peoples have been bringing to the table, whether within the Indigenous Peoples Caucus, whether it's in the streets here in Glasgow, which we'll see in the marches, whether it's in the streets in our home, fighting our institutions in the colonial places where we live to fight these institutions and corporations. We all brought one issue to the table. And the issue was that systems of capitalism and colonialism have robbed us of our dignity and our ability to enter into these spaces. And that we are saying that if we do not reconcile the fact that these structures have marginalized us and oppressed us, and our relationships to the living world, that we will continue to replicate the harms that we're doing not only to our people as communities, but to the planet.
For the second Indigenous listening session, we arranged a meeting between four Indigenous leaders and Prince Charles. Given the implication of church, state, and royalty in the history of colonization and the impact that colonization has had on Indigenous communities worldwide, it felt like a poignant moment to bring these different people together in recognition of the need for us to all work together at this critical moment. I remain forever amazed by the generous spirit of reconciliation that it seems so many Indigenous voices are bringing to the table. That in spite of this painful history, many Indigenous people are reaching out, travelling even to places like Scotland, to try and build bridges and find ways to work together to move forward in this critical moment in time. This spirit of working together, of reconciliation, permeated the language of many of the speakers. You'll hear now from Tom, Sonia, Mindahi, Chief Ninawa, Gregorio Diaz Mirabal, a leader from the Venezuelan Amazon and the general coordinator of COICA, the largest Indigenous association in the Amazon Basin, and Victoria Tali Corpus.
I'm here as a representative of spiritual authorities who said, you can speak about this to the people. I'm here also as a voice of many people in our confederacy, our alliance, our network of Indigenous peoples of the land, the grassroots, founded by youth, founded by women societies, founded by our elders in 1990. It was a time that we had to come together in the United States to address the issues of racism, calling attention to why is it that a colonial government that have people who occupied our territories, and a lot of them, yes, in reality, they came from Europe, they came from England, they came from Sweden. So this is our reality, to fight for our survival, to fight for a rights-based approach in the hallways of these UN meetings.
In the second listening session, Tom specifically asked Prince Charles,
how do we express when we talk about rebuilding our communities after hundreds of years of impact of colonization? And how do we have a just transition back that utilizes our traditional knowledge?
I bring with me a message from the warrior Indigenous women of Brazil, warriors who are defenders of ancestrality. colonization has attempted to bury our bodies and suffocate our cosmologies. But we are here to say that the shift in the economical model is urgent. We would like to connect your energy with our spirituality. This is an urgent call. We are here to join forces with all of the international community and network to take on this commitment together with Your Highness and all of the people involved to help protect our forests and together so we can save Mother Earth.
We have to go from the I to the we, from the me to the we. It is the time. Any world leader should come together with us. We are tired. We got to work together. There is no just one nation. There is diversity of nations. And we want to honor original nations here. And we want your support. And you also need our support. We are together. So we call here for the unification process. We call here for the responsibility now and then. This is the time. And the time is now.
Eu queria também dizer que
one thing that I wish to see myself one day, but I also wish for my children and my grandchildren to be able to experience and live through, is the moment in which we have our elders, our wise ones from our people, together with the modern and scientists of this place, of this part of the world, to be discussing, tackling concrete solutions for the way that we can exist on planet Earth.
We are here from very far away because there are no answers in our lands and we need help and support. The Amazon is important for all the humanity and our only worry is to keep it alive. We cannot do it alone. We have very few time to do something. We have 5 years to do something that can save us from this climate catastrophe. And this is my message. Help us. Help us defend the water, the life, for everyone. We don't want our house to burn. We want the Amazon alive.
There are technologies, innovations, and knowledge of indigenous peoples that can indeed contribute to solving the crisis. Constructive intercultural dialogue is really the way to go.
Prince Charles responded thus.
One of the things I've been trying to say for so long is that we need to listen to the wisdom and understanding, the spirituality of indigenous people around the world. I've tried to get across the point that in the modern world, we've lost that all-important sense of the sacred. We've lost that sixth sense, if you know what I mean, which should have warned us not to do what we've been doing for so long to the world around us and to nature. Now, of course, it's taken such a long time for people finally to be aware of the catastrophe that has been engineered by not listening to your wisdom and knowledge.
Listening is critical, but maybe more critical is what happens after listening. What are the actions taken? I'm really happy to share that following the listening sessions, the Prince and his Sustainable Market Initiative followed up with Quaker Gregorio and Sacred Headwaters and are exploring ways to support youth leadership, reforestation, and value chains for alternative livelihoods, different projects in the Amazon. What might we learn from ancient wisdom to help us navigate this crisis? What does listening deeply call on you and I and all of us to do? I'll try and summarize some of the key actions that many of these Indigenous leaders spoke to. Even though they came from different cultures, different continents, there were similar messages repeated again and again across these different voices. First and foremost, many of them, like most activists, scientists, indeed the International Energy Agency, and arguably any sane person would do today, called for the end of fossil fuel development, for no more exploration, and for fossil fuel subsidies to be stopped. You'll hear on this from Ariel, Tom, and Chief Ninawa.
We have hit rock bottom in our addictions to fossil fuels.
The bathtub of the sky is overflowing with too much carbon. It's overflowing with too much greenhouse gases. How we start moving away from our dependency on a fossil fuel economy, How do we address the addiction?
The first thing I wish to ask the world leaders is that they leave the oil underground.
Many of the speakers also spoke over and again about the need to protect indigenous land rights, which is a political responsibility, but also a corporate responsibility and therefore a consumer responsibility, as most, if not all, of the land encroachments faced by indigenous communities around the world come from companies driven by their supply chains, whether that's mining for gold, cattle farming, growing soy to feed cattle farming, or sourcing tropical hardwood. Many of the speakers also spoke of the threats to environmental defenders who have been criminalized and sometimes killed for trying to protect the natural world. A report from Global Witness estimates that an environmental defender is killed every day or two.
Here is Mindahi, Sonia, Chief Nanawa, and Victoria.
The lands of original nations and peoples are in danger because of urban sprawl, mining, because of the land market. Now because of the rare earths, genetic resources, traditional knowledge, because of gold, because of diamonds.
Many of the products that make their way to these lands, are actually at the cost of indigenous blood.
And
that for all these other kinds of investments, such as building dams or mining companies, I will ask for these companies that they leave our sacred territories alone. Today in Brazil, we have a law, an attempt of a law to pass in our Congress that means to exclude and terminate with the rights of we as the First Nations and the original people of these lands. And that takes place now not only in Brazil, but all over, all across the Americas, as well as South America, which is ultimately a further attempt to exterminate us, is a genocide attempt. I wish to see the government stop murdering our sacred territories. Our sacred territories are the places we inhabit, are our lands. We want to see them take responsibility as well as be punished for the murdering of our people, for the murdering of our territories. We need to have legal tools to see this bringing results in the law.
Most of the investments that come in that affect indigenous people's territories and is when incentives are offered to big industrial corporations to encroach in indigenous people's land. I used to be the UN Special Rapporteur on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, and I just finished my term last year. But that's one of the things I saw in doing my mandate, that many incentives are offered by investors to the countries to expand their agricultural, industrial agriculture to the lands. And this has caused displacements and of course, assassinations of some indigenous people. So I would like to also stress that there should be a stop. Corporations, the businesses should prevent the criminalization and the assassinations that are happening to indigenous peoples. The latest Global Witness report shows that people are killed every day, and out of the 290 killed last year, 30% of those are indigenous leaders. So I just like to appeal that this will be stopped.
And beyond protection, there is also the question of empowerment. Have indigenous communities been given a sufficient legal seat at the table? What representation do they currently have in gatherings like COP? What should they have? It was very disheartening to learn that fossil fuel lobbyists at COP26 represented a delegation bigger than any country in the world, and the delegation twice as big as the number of indigenous people present. Ariel, Tom, and Chief Ninawa reflected on some of these concerns.
I once heard from my Sami sister from Norway. She said, "We as indigenous people are not jam or jelly. We are not to be preserved and consumed. We cannot afford the continued co-optation of indigenous peoples and our knowledge. We need to be empowered to have a seat at the table and to speak for ourselves. But here in these spaces, we don't have a seat at the table."
In the UN system, we're observers. We're not involved in the negotiation process. Communities of the world, the populations that are most vulnerable, the communities that are experiencing disproportionate impact of unpredictable weather events, whether it's in the Pacific, whether it's in the melting ice in the north, or whether it's the great floods and drought conditions. Those people should be here, and they are not. So who holds this, the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change accountable? What is the mechanisms of accountability?
A COP precisa mudar.
COP has become this great financial gathering to talk about investments and markets, when actually the most affected people and the most affected communities and territories are left outside of the conversation and are not given the space. So we need to change the strategy in which this conversation is held.
In the context of COP being understood as a trade event, conversations on finance did in many ways dominate. There were many urgent calls for more funding to be allocated towards climate-vulnerable countries and indigenous peoples. There was also a lot of discussion of the $100 billion that had been promised to be given from rich nations to poor nations annually from 2020 onwards to help countries deal with adaptation and mitigation. At the time of COP26, this promise hadn't been met. Fulfill your promises, nations were calling on. There were also increasing calls for a new fund to be established for loss and damage, a reparations of sorts to help poorer nations and climate vulnerable countries and communities deal with the costs of the climate crisis that they're already bearing. This is an issue of climate justice, considering that many of the communities that are bearing the worst impacts of the climate crisis have actually historically contributed the least towards creating this crisis, and many of which don't have the resources to deal with it. For example, Agnes Lena, who comes from the Samburu community, a subset of the Maasai people in northern Kenya, said this.
One thing I would want the COP to do is act. They've listened enough. They've heard enough from us. Just do something, even if it is small. There's so much that has been spoken about financing and all that. Where does that money go to? It's not a sin to ask. Where does the money go to? There's so much money that's circulating. Where does it go to? If it's not going to indigenous people who are being affected by climate change, if it's not going to the women who are being affected by climate change, then where is it going to?
One of the breakthrough positive stories from COP26 was that £14 billion had been pledged from private and public funding to the conservation of forests worldwide, with over 100 countries agreeing to try and halt deforestation by 2030. And so as part of this funding deal, over £1 billion was pledged in support of Indigenous and local communities' land tenure. In announcing this deal, the Environment Minister, Lord Zach Goldsmith, who I spoke to for season one of this podcast, said the following about the deal's ambitions and risks.
The difference between this package that we've presented today and previous packages, besides being significantly bigger, is that there are 11 core components to it, and each one of those components will reinforce the other. So there's no point just having leaders telling us that we're going to stop deforestation by 2030 if you don't have finance. There's no point having finance and those commitments if you're not also tackling the levers that are driving deforestation. That means breaking the link between commodities and deforestation. There's no point having even that package unless you don't also ensure that the financial institutions are in line with this aspiration, with this vision. We could raise all the public finance in the world, but it will never compare with the amount of money that's flowing into the problem through financial institutions, through banks, through multilateral development banks, through misplaced subsidies by governments. So I think we've got a package here which is complementary, mutually reinforcing, on a scale beyond anything we've seen before. It will still require scrutiny. And that's why, to steal a phrase from Greenpeace, we want radical transparency throughout this process. So we're talking about very significant sums of money. And of course, it's public money. So the public will want to know that that money is being spent properly. And that hasn't always been the case in the past in relation to well-intentioned investments to try and stop deforestation. So the monitoring is an absolutely core part. We could quadruple the pledge that we've announced today from public money. It will not match, it will not come close to matching the amount of money that's currently being invested in the problem, in causing deforestation. But I think that's why the commitments and announcements that were made today from the financial institutions, representing around nearly $9 trillion worth of investment, the commitment made by the big multilateral development banks to reconcile their portfolios with nature, not just Paris, And other commitments that are coming forward from the private sector around going nature positive are so important. How do we know these commitments are going to be kept to? But we do know from significant forest countries around the world that they're taking it very seriously. And it was precisely the signal sent by the private sector that has made our job easier in terms of getting those 114 countries to make the 2030 forest pledge.
Many of the indigenous leaders welcome this announcement, while also adding caution to it, echoing Agnes's concerns. Here, for example, is Mindahi reflecting on this pledge.
There was announced that $1,700 million American dollars were going to be put in service for original nations. But we are concerned because sometimes these monies don't arrive to at the local level, and when they arrive, they destroy the relationships among people, what we call harmony between leaders of original nations and the community. Sometimes national governments just work with aligned leaders. So what we suggest is that there should be more independent observance, more independent follow-up, supervision around these funds. It was announced that at least $100 million need to be transferred to the Global South. And as I said before, it's another concern because of corruption. So it also needs to be observed and to be followed up. In summary, we can say that in some ways it has been the best COP we have seen, not just in participation, but also in presence and in commitments. But what we need now is how we can follow up. Otherwise, as we say, we are too late, because we need to protect our territories, to legally protect the 80% of biodiversity of the world, and also to related biocultural heritage, which are in the indigenous people's territories.
After COP, I reached out to a conservationist I really trust and admire, John Burton, co-founder of the World Land Trust, who's been doing on-the-ground conservation work for most of his life, working closely with local communities around the world. I asked his thoughts.
My main thing is I'm really against the one brush paints everything approach. And unfortunately, that's what happens with big UN assemblies and things like the Conference of the Parties 26. It tries to apply one thing, and putting billions of dollars into a project doesn't necessarily solve it. One of the things I can say quite confidently is I've probably over the years seen more conservation projects ruined by too much money than too little. Throwing money at projects is a very sort of Western, particularly US, approach to solving problems. And in many parts of the world, particularly when you're dealing with small local communities and indigenous communities, throwing money at the problem is often the very worst thing you can do. We need to consult with them what they want, not what we think they need. And most of Western aid is dumped on foreign countries saying, this is what we think you need. It isn't what they ask for, it's what we, in our arrogant way, have decided they need. And the difficulty is actually finding out what they do need. I did some very superficial research with the Guarani Indians in Misiones. I say very superficial because I don't speak the language. I had to use an interpreter. But I asked the caciques, the chiefs, what do you want? And they said, we want to own our forests. We want to defend our sacred places. We want to bring up our children here. We want to live here for the future generations. I then went and asked the women without the caciques and the men around what they wanted. And they said they wanted access to healthcare and food supplies, and they wanted their children to go to school. I then asked some kids what they wanted, and they said, we want to go to school, and then we want to go to Asuncion or the big cities. And this is why I've started working with anthropologists, because I think they're the right people to try, if anyone, to try and get an understanding of what the communities really want and really help them develop in a way that isn't going to be negative. Because throwing big amounts of money at poor communities is usually unsustainable. I've seen more semi-derelict schools in my travels than I like to see, because people love infrastructure projects. They love building schools. I can take you and show you a wonderful research station in the middle of the Chaco. absolutely denuded of all its equipment because the Spanish government funded the building of it but didn't fund anyone to actually stay in it and do research. And within weeks, the whole place had been looted. I can show you lots of examples like that. And so governments committing billions doesn't impress me at all.
One of the most thought-provoking things I heard during COP was the critique of focus on economic solutions to the climate crisis. Having personally advocated in the past for carbon pricing, for example, as we discussed in season one of this podcast, and market-based solutions and sensitive types of offsets, it was interesting to listen to this critique. Indeed, I had first travelled to the Amazon and met with the Yawanawa tribe when I was researching economic ways to discourage deforestation, working with WWF on the wild rubber supply chain, inspired by the activist Chico Mendes. Our logic was that if you make the forest worth more standing than cut down, you discourage the practices that are driving deforestation. Yet some of the indigenous speakers called me to ask deeper, maybe more spiritual questions of this line of thinking. By focusing so heavily on economic tools to solve the crisis, are we leading towards the financialization of nature, the commodification of the sacred? Tom Goldtooth really got me thinking about this. This is what he said.
So what are the solutions that we saw coming out of this conference of the parties, of the governments of the world? What does this have to do with our indigenous knowledge? The main mechanism that has been developed in those hallways is around the financialization of nature, the commodification of the sacred, the privatization. Before you trade carbon in a trading market system, you got to determine whose property right it is. Becomes a property right issue. Carbon, air, atmosphere, even the trees. The carbon is the trading mechanism. So some of you may offset your trip in the airplane. You feel good about yourself. The indulgences of the Catholic Church to pay money to relieve yourself of your guilt. We support the restoration of nature. We support the restoration of soil, of our trees, of the mangroves, of the ocean, the blue ocean, they call it. But outside of a market system,
I asked John, is there a sensitive way to do carbon offsetting and what role can it play in our world today?
Well, as far as I'm concerned, avoided deforestation is a very, very simple concept. Instead of going around planting trees to absorb all the carbon dioxide, it's much, much simpler to prevent trees being cut down in the first place. It's a much more cost-effective way of doing carbon offsetting, and it has other benefits because it also conserves all the wildlife that goes with a natural habitat. There are lots of arguments against carbon offsetting. But the great thing about avoided deforestation is in addition to the carbon offsetting, it is conserving biodiversity. And that, to my mind, is the most important aspect of it. I'm not going to go into the economics of carbon offsetting or the politics because it is very, very complex and, as ever, is always dependent on how and where you're doing it. But I would still recommend that sort of model of buying up land, having it managed in conjunction or owned by local communities and making sure the local communities benefit from any income that's derived from it. Yeah? So I see carbon offset income as a form of land tax that goes to the communities who are conserving it.
I'd once travelled with John to India to look at the development of elephant corridors and met with some of the local villagers who they were working with in order to develop elephant corridors. And so I asked John a bit more about his experience doing conservation work for many decades, working with local communities.
Yeah, I'm very much on the side of the local communities. I tend to avoid using the term indigenous peoples because I'm never quite sure what it actually means. It means different things in different parts of the world, and it's a very complicated issue. I'm really concerned about the people who live in and around protected areas, whether they're indigenous, campesinas, whatever, they've all got human rights, and that's the thing that's important. The way we've done that when I was working with the World Land Trust and with the organisations I'm currently working with is by acquiring land that can be used for carbon offsetting or avoided deforestation and vesting the land ownership rights in the local communities. Or in many cases now, working with local communities that already own the land. I'm currently working in Armenia. I've done work in Vietnam. And what we're doing there is acquiring the carbon offset, the value in the carbon, to help them manage the land sustainably. Every single case is different. What you cannot do is stand up at a UN assembly and say, this is what must be done. You can't do that because every single case I've worked on is either very different or slightly different from others. And the models that you use in South America probably will never work in somewhere like Africa. I mean, in Africa, I've done projects in the past. In Uganda, we worked out, I think there were 7 different land tenures involved, some of which overlapped with each other. So working out who actually owns the land in the first place is very, very difficult. In many places, the concept of land ownership is completely alien to the culture. Most nomadic tribes in most parts of the world don't have this concept of land ownership. And most tribes are not indigenous to one area. Nomads roam over huge areas. So you can get real complications if someone says, oh, we've got to let this lot own all the land because they're indigenous and they've been roaming over tens of thousands of hectares. It's not going to be acceptable to the rest of the people who live in that area. So you immediately start a conflict.
When Australia was colonised, the land that's now called Australia, there was this, is it terra nullius? The idea that because nobody who was living there had a sense of property right, therefore it was kind of unoccupied land and therefore could be claimed.
Yeah, this is true for most parts of the world that were colonised in that way.
Yeah.
Because people didn't have concept of property rights, right, we'll develop them for them. I mean, that's precisely what happened in most of South America. The whole area has been cadastralized, that there are lines drawn across every country in South America, virtually mapping it out, saying who owns what. Now, those ownership lines also crisscross territorial claims by a number of indigenous groups, local communities, whatever you like to call them. And this is where the conflict arises.
When reflecting on the outcomes of COP, Mindahi Bashtida expressed similar concerns to Tom, whilst welcoming the initiatives to help fund and finance indigenous communities.
Commodification of life is killing. It's killing the sacred. It's killing the spiritual connection with nature as humans. Of course, we can work together with those entities, financial entities, but they need to respect life in a sacred way. Because financial institutions are important, but it's more important that they understand that commodification of life is killing life itself. Even the financial world are beginning to open their ears, but they need to open their arms, they need to open their thoughts, and to think in a beautiful way, with clean ideas.
Opening hearts was the resounding call made by environmental and climate activist Elizabeth Watuti, who attended the first Indigenous listening session with us. Elizabeth was at COP to remind people of why this work is essential, of the suffering happening on the front lines of the climate crisis already being felt today. This was the message she brought to COP in her speech at the opening ceremony.
I need to tell you what is happening in my home country. Right now, over 2 million of my fellow Kenyans are facing climate-related starvation. In this past year, both of our rainy seasons have failed, and scientists say that it may be another 12 months before the waters return again. Meanwhile, our rivers are running dry, our harvests are failing, our storehouses stand empty, our animals and people are dying. I have seen with my own eyes 3 young children crying at the side of a dried up river after walking 12 miles with their mother to find water. Please open your hearts. This is not only happening in Kenya. Over the past few months, there have been deadly heat waves and wildfires in Algeria and devastating floods in Uganda and Nigeria. And there is more still to come. By 2025, in just 4 years' time, half of the world's population will be facing water scarcity. If you allow yourself to feel it, the heartbreak and the injustice is hard to bear. Sub-Saharan Africans are responsible for just 0.5% of historical emissions. The children are responsible for none, but they are bearing the brunt. We are the adults on this earth right now, and it is our responsibility to ensure that the children have food and water. I believe in our human capacity to care deeply and to act collectively. I believe in our ability to do what is right if we let ourselves feel it in our hearts. The children cannot live on words and empty promises. They are waiting for you to act.
The mindset and perspective that Elizabeth called for, to think of the children, reflects the mindset that many Indigenous communities have long called attention to. That of time, of deep time, of looking into the past to ancestry and looking into the future to the generations not yet with us. Instead of the focus on the short time frames that modern society often demands, whether it's 4 or 5 year political cycles, annual budgets and reports, or even the 2030, 2050 goals made in these international agreements. Many Indigenous communities have called on their communities to consider multiple generations past and present when making decisions. For example, Jihe Bashtida, the youth activist and daughter of Mindahi Bashtida, told me during COP that their lineage, the Atomi Toltec Nation, asks that people consider the 7 generations past to guide action in the present, and also consider the 7 generations ahead to take into account those inheriting the earth. The Iroquois famously also have a 7-generation principle. And the storyteller Mac McCarthy hosts children's fires inspired by an Indigenous practice of making political decisions when gathered around a fire after making a commitment to all children, present and future. In the same way that the idea of nature as sacred permeated much of the language of Indigenous speakers, so too did references to ancestrality and to children. As part of the first listening session, Selina Leem, an Indigenous youth activist from the Marshall Islands, read a poem she had written. It reflected on the way that children of the nation were trying to save the land of their ancestors, as many youth activists around the world know well today. And it also reflected on what that loss might mean, that the connection to the land was not just the land itself, but the connection to their ancestors, and that could never be replaced. Here's an extract from Selina's poem.
This poem I wrote, it's titled She Grew Giant, and it talks about the impacts of the climate crisis in my country, as well as the impacts of the nuclear testing that the United States did in my country right after World War II. Into the horizons we march, children with skinny, gangly limbs, each tiny step on the reef that comes out of hiding during low tide. A warrior determination our ancestors would have sang their praises for. For our home, for our country, us little warriors will save. Each year, we saw the corals less. The waves grew bigger. My uncle's house got torn down. They ran out with their screeching baby, their belongings swallowed by the ocean. The day our smiles cracked, our seawalls cracked, savaged down to broken pieces of hope and fear. Our hope crumpled down with our fortress. Our fear rose with each rising wave, night after night with each high tide. But people forget. The media turns a blind eye to that in a state of anger, fear, and panic, people act. We do not flee. We act. We will not flee. We will act. Because with each rising wave is our rising resilience. Juma told me, Jelena, your needs
will last you a lifetime. Your wants will not. So tread carefully. No, it is not in 2040, 2050, no. Yesterday's and today. Now is what I need you to respond to. I've seen bones of loved ones spilling out of broken graves, torn by the angry waves. Nightmares haunt me at night and follows me throughout the day. The terror I feel. Act now. I stand here, ngay judagijin, for my people, for my home. Our corals never grew to be the giant we needed them to be, to protect us from the rising water. But I did, to 5'3". The giant to protect my home from the ways of deniers and work hand in hand with those fighting for our planet. Together, each of us, like the tiny corals my friends and I gathered and put out in a horizontal line near the outer reef, grow tall to stay, to be the giants for our planet.
After Selena read her poem, my six-year-old daughter came over to me and tugged at my sleeve. She wanted to say something, so I passed her the mic.
Wow, thank you. That was such a beautiful way to close this part of the session. I think the youngest person amongst us tells me she wants to say something. Do you actually want to say something?
I like that that she wants to save the world.
She likes that you want to save the world. Me too. It was so sweet that I was asked afterwards if it was planned. It most certainly wasn't. But it was a beautiful reminder of the future that children represent already present with us today. Sometimes the dates in these international negotiations and the language around climate change can sound abstract. 2030, 2050 can sound pretty far away. I did the maths when I wrote my book to try and make it a bit more real what these dates mean, and realized that my daughter, who was born in 2015, will be around my age in 2050. And like all other girls on the planet right now, she already carries the eggs of the next generation in her womb, which means that the people who'll be alive in 2100, maybe even 2150, are already biologically present with us. The climate crisis isn't some abstract future possibility. It is already happening now, today. We are living through it. We are the generation. Especially felt in communities that are living in close proximity to nature, whose lifestyles are dependent on the weather. And these impacts will no doubt be felt more significantly in the years to come. And therefore, many talk of an intergenerational injustice, considering the world that the next generation and the generation that follow will have to inherit. This was the other message carried by all of the Indigenous speakers. Indeed, perhaps the reason that many of them came. That the impacts of the climate crisis are being felt already today. Here is what Mindahi from Mexico, Agnes from Kenya, and Christiana from Brazil had to say about the places from which they traveled.
We are living through very critical times because we have misbehaved. When I was growing up, I used to swim in the precious Date, the Lerma River. You cannot swim anymore now. Zero oxygen. When I was growing up, I saw the beautiful butterflies, the most beautiful butterflies you can ever imagine. The colors, the red, the orange, the blue fluorescent. You cannot find them anymore. What is happening to us? Don't we remember that we are just humans? We are not the peak of the creation. We are just another species.
Gone are those days when we see butterflies. And we know for sure rains are somewhere around the corner. We miss those days. I can tell you that for sure. Because of climate change. And that's the thing that we are facing every day. The pastoralist people that I represent. The people who look after cows. Our bank account is in our livestock. Now there is climate change. Gone are the days when you say, okay, where is this bird? We have not seen it in a while. They've been wiped out. Drought does not just affect the cows and the goats and the people. It affects even the birds of the air. They reduce in number. They die or they move. They shift to other places. Right now, as we talk, we do not have water in Kajiado. It has not rained. October, it should have rained. We do not have tap water. Water justice is a problem, not just in Kenya, not just in pastoralist communities, but in the whole of Africa. With all the technology that we have about water, we still have so much shortage of water. And why? It's because of climate change.
The same problem with the lack of water that she is facing all the way in Africa, we are facing as well in Brazil. And at some point, some of you here might experience the lack of water too. What we are sharing is in fact our reality. It is a reality that is also filled with a pain of knowing hunger, a pain of knowing the lack of resources, and a pain of knowing the lack of water. We are trying to warn you what the lack of our fundamental needs might generate in the world.
At the end of the conference, I think there was a great sense of disappointment from the activists, indigenous community members, a huge sense of grief that this had been a really critical moment, and unfortunately, the outcome of COP26 hadn't really risen to that challenge. I reached out to the Indigenous leaders to see if they wanted to share any reflections on the outcome of COP26, and Gregorio said to me, "I came to this COP26 with high hopes, that the final agreement would finally include the rapid phasing out of fossil fuels. Given that the oil and coal industry has caused so much damage to the Amazon rainforest, and is the biggest contributor to our climate crisis, I also called for governments to stop subsidies to fossil fuels. These demands were not truly addressed in the Glasgow Agreement, and that means the G20 has failed again to commit to a just ecological transition. Future generations are counting on us, but our governments have let them down." Gregorio also added, "There were a few hopeful outcomes. I would like to acknowledge that governments made important commitments to curbing deforestation, and they pledged to finance indigenous-led solutions." Sonia wrote to me in a dispirited way. She wrote, "Countries say that they're worried about the increase of temperature reaching the 1.5 degree limit, but their practices do not change. The attitudes remain the same. They are always thinking about mass production for the unrestrained consumption of society to generate more profits. But what is the point of so much investment and profits once there is no more life? It is time to regain awareness of what is really at stake." In Sonia's final message, I was reminded of her and other Amazonian women's calls to reforest hearts and minds. As Christiana put it,
"Each one of us must do our own part and to connect ourselves with what is really sacred, because this, the sacred, is what keeps us living. We, the indigenous people, indigenous women of Brazil, our work is very much based on our life philosophy, which is to reforest minds in the literal sense, as well as an analogy. To reforest our thoughts, but also to reforest our feelings, our affections, and our way of nurturing and caring for each other, and especially reforesting our actions."
I think that was perhaps the biggest message and calling I heard from these disparate speakers, that the real shift that needs to happen is in the way we feel, think, and see the world and our relationship to it, what we choose to value. Here is Mindahi and Tom again.
"When we pray, we acknowledge all living beings, including this marvelous Mother Earth. And remembering that we are traveling, we are travelers. So we are not just forever, just for a while. Just for a while."
"You all were given teachings sometime, long time ago. Your tribalism, your way of prayer and appreciation and thanksgiving for what you have been given every day, from the time the sun comes up to the time the sun goes down. So where are those teachings that have been passed on to you? Where are those knowledge holders here in Europe that once had that knowledge and those teachings of relationship?"
Is this the most important question to be asked? What does it mean to be Indigenous? What was the culture in the United Kingdom, for example, centuries and centuries, if not millennia ago, before that land was effectively colonised? To close the Indigenous listening session, we invited the folk singer and writer Sam Lee to sing. Sam Lee has dedicated his adult life trying to track down some of the oldest cultures in the UK, learning and trying to preserve songlines from this land.
This is a song that I feel says much about the life, the journeys we take. It's a song from the Indigenous people of this land, from the Gypsy travellers, those people who have been most oppressed in our country, in these islands, yet are also the people who've been custodians to our nature here, which is in great trouble. This is a song of hope. It's a song for the moon. It's called "The Moon Shines Bright."
The moon shines bright, and the stars give a light. In a little while it will be day. The voice of love, it calls upon us all and bids us awake and pray. Arise, arise, away thee arise. For life she is calling thee. For it might be the mothering of your sweet souls if you open your eyes and see that the life of a man, it comes with little plan. It flourishes like a flower, as tender in the heart into which we're born. So cherish your every hour, for our time is not long. Time's an old folk song. No longer can we stay. Those that remember say, blessed are you all who make it through this brawl. Long life and another good year. Blessed are you all who answer to the call. Long life and another good year. For the moon shines bright, and the stars will be our height. Life, she is calling thee. Arise, arise, awake thee, arise, and evermore watchful.
That was the beautiful song, "The Moon Shines Bright," by the beautiful man, Sam Lee, as performed and recorded at the first listening session in COP, and then later embellished by me and the wonderful Angolan singer, Toti Samed. The practice of using songlines to carry traditional wisdom and ancestral information across generations exists in many different cultures around the world. Tom Goldtooth and Ariel Duranja also shared songs with us at the listening sessions, which I'll share extracts from to close this episode. Having moved between these two parallel realities, between the outside, the marches, the youth activists, the Indigenous listening sessions, and the inside of COP, which felt pragmatic, even at times infertile,
I came to wonder, is this a fundamentally spiritual crisis? A crisis in our relationship to each other and the natural world and life itself? The beautiful promise in this question and this thought is that it gives each of us agency. Maybe we don't need to place all of our hope in the cops of this world, in the politicians and the corporate leaders to make pragmatic change. Maybe the inner work is essential, a deep shift that each of us can feel called to do, can actively seek to practice. And in societies like many of ours, which have escalating mental health crises, we might just find that trying to make these shifts in our relationship to the world around us, to nature, might make us happier too. Thanks so much for tuning in. Wishing you a beautiful year ahead until we connect again. This episode was made possible with the support of impossible.com, a technology incubator that tries to bring together modern innovation and technology with older and deeper values through a practice we call planet-centric design. The Indigenous listening sessions upon which this episode is based were made possible with the support of Flourishing Diversity, the Isla Foundation, and Grounded.org. The events were also supported by Goals House, the Sustainable Markets Initiative. And a huge thanks to all the team at Mags Creative, and in particular, Kit and Amber, who've worked so hard trying to edit together hours of content into this story, into this narrative for you. A huge thanks to all of our listeners at the events and you for listening too. And of course, a huge thanks, the deepest gratitude to all of our Indigenous speakers for coming, for sharing, for opening hearts and minds.
Hey, Masicho, hi.